You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, it's the Friday News Roundup. You'll get updates on Ukraine, plus analysis on what Russia's invasion means for those in Europe and for us here in the U.S. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, after Russia's invasion of Ukraine, many experts and global leaders say the post-Cold War era has ended. If that's the case, this moment can mean big changes for the relationship between Russia and Western countries like the U.S., and it could have long-lasting effects on American foreign policy. We're talking about the significance of this moment, what those changes could look like, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts, your feelings, your reactions to Russia's decision to invade its neighbor? Does this moment take you back to other moments in world history? How do you think Western countries should respond, if at all? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Jeremy Suri is a professor of history and public affairs at the LBJ School of Public Affairs and the Department of History at the University of Texas at Austin. He's the author of the book Civil War by Other Means, America's Long and Unfinished Fight for Democracy. Jeremy, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, it's nice to be back in conversation with you.
Big picture, Jeremy, is this a turning point? Is this an end of some kind of post-Cold War era?
Yes. We have been fortunate since really 1991 to be able to assume that the borders around Russia and in Central Europe are pretty stable, and that this is a region that would be relatively peaceful. We had a war in Yugoslavia, but north of that border, the presumption of peace and cooperation and the growth of the European Union and NATO, these were all assumed factors, and they're no longer assumptions we can make.
You were with us on this show after Russia effectively absorbed Crimea. And you were worried then about that as a precedent for future behavior from Russia. Is what's happening this week surprising given that and what's been happening in eastern Ukraine leading up to this?
Well, the aggression by Vladimir Putin and the efforts by Vladimir Putin to incorporate territories around Russia that have large Russian populations, Crimea being one, the Donbas, the eastern part of Ukraine, is the other, that is not surprising in the least. What is surprising, startling to me, in spite of the intelligence that should have led us to think this was going to happen, is the overwhelming use of force and what really appears to be an effort on Putin's part to take control of all of Ukraine. We should just remember that the western part of Ukraine was never part of Russia. It was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It is a part of Ukraine that has no historical connection, in fact, to Russia. And so the fact that he's seeking to take control, to conquer areas where there really isn't a Russian claim in such an overwhelming, forceful way, that's startling. That just doesn't look like the 20th century. It looks like the 19th century, really.
Are there things you think that the United States, say, and NATO allies could have done to prevent this?
Well, I think if we go back over the last couple of decades, Rob, I think, yes, there were a number of things that could have been done, and some would have involved carrots, some would have involved sticks. I think there is a fair argument to be made that the expansion of NATO into the eastern areas, including not just Poland and the Czech Republic, but the Baltic states, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, and talk of bringing Ukraine in, that this contributed to insecurity in Russia, and we should have done more to reassure Russians. On the stick side, as you pointed out, Vladimir Putin has been using military force in his backyard going back to the time of George W. Bush's presidency when he also invaded the country of Georgia. So we probably should have done more also to respond and deter his use of military force. I think we've been complacent. And we've all assumed that we're not going to see war in that part of the world anymore. Until 2 days ago, it was unthinkable for us.
There's a chicken or egg aspect with NATO expansion here. Russia saying, hey, bringing NATO's borders east is a provocation to us. On the other hand, small countries on Russia's border want the protections of NATO because they fear this sort of action from Russia. Now we're hearing Finland and Sweden saying, hey, yeah, maybe NATO. Russia saying that's going to have consequences if you join. I don't know. How do you sort that out?
That is one of the biggest strategic dilemmas that we confront now. The act of joining NATO is seen as provocative and aggressive by Russia, but yet it's totally logical and legitimate for countries that have a history of encountering Russian military force and being smaller and on the short end of the outcomes, want the protection of NATO. Finland fought a long war with Russia on the eve of World War II, and they have very strong reasons to believe that they need NATO protection now, especially watching Russian behavior. I think what we have to be able to do is expand NATO into countries that are willing to comply with NATO requirements and that have a legitimate claim to be part of a self-defense alliance. But we do have to do things to assure the Russian people that this is not an anti-Russian alliance, which NATO does not have to be. So we have to find a way to square that circle. That's the mix of diplomacy and military affairs. And we have to do better, but there's no easy route to that end.
Talking to Jeremy Suri from the University of Texas at Austin, looking at the Russian invasion of Ukraine, what it means for the future of American foreign policy. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Lisa is with us in Madison. Lisa, hi.
Hi, I've been listening and reading lately about how after the end of the Cold War, when politicians here felt, you know, we didn't have to worry about that any longer, they focused on deregulating our financial system, which we have since found out has enabled Russian oligarchs to use the U.S. as a significant money laundering vessel. And then that laundered money often goes into the pockets of politicians who then write policy that favors the Russian oligarchs. And so I'm wondering if we end up back in a Cold War, how that may look or what may change in that in terms of that issue.
Lisa, thanks for the call. Interesting question, and it's happening as the U.S. and allies are blocking a longer list of actors in Russia to their access to exactly that kind of banking money she's talking about. Jeremy, what are your thoughts?
I think Lisa's spot on. There's an intersection between political economy and strategy here that is often missed when we're looking at these issues purely from a military political frame of thought. As she says, as Lisa says, many of the most powerful figures in Russia, the so-called oligarchs, use their ill-begotten wealth in Russia to invest in the United States and particularly in England and other parts of Europe. They hide their money there and they use their money to curry influence. And that is part of the story of Donald Trump. And as a consequence, that has led us to pursue policies that have often been not rigorous enough in resisting Russian financial corruption as well as strategic aggression. That is changing now. I don't think it's changing fast enough. But many of the sanctions that have been levied by the Biden administration and by the European Union will limit the access that oligarchs have had to the banking system and will limit their ability to buy property and even to travel. Just today, the European Union and the United States have now sanctioned Vladimir Putin. He has, by most accounts, hundreds of billions of dollars invested in Switzerland, in London, in the United States. He will not be able to use that money. And there are many other oligarchs like him. I think we've only begun to really interrogate this issue. And this is an area where we do need to crack down more.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Jeremy, I've seen some analysts paint this as not just, you know, Vladimir Putin aggression on his borders and local security issues, but a wider issue of Vladimir Putin making the world safe for authoritarian government in some ways, a challenge to democratically run governments. Is that overstating it, or do you think there's something to that?
I think there's something to that, but we need to frame that properly. The regional security issues that Vladimir Putin has are directly connected to this question about democracy. He is fearful of more colored revolutions, as we saw in Ukraine a number of years ago, as we've seen in Kazakhstan in recent months. Vladimir Putin believes that popular activism and efforts by mobilized citizens to take control of their governments, that those movements are manipulated by the U.S., and he believes that they undermine Russian influence in that region. And so he wants to cut off democratic change and enforce authoritarian rule, as he's done in Belarus most recently, propping up the leader there, Lukashenko, who has faced a lot of popular opposition. So the anti-democratic and regional security issues go hand in hand for Putin. Now, I don't think he's seeking to end democracy in all of Europe or in North America, What he's seeking to do is strengthen friendly authoritarian regimes around Russia, and that includes China as well. He's seeking to build a regional bloc of authoritarian states that, again, would approximate not the Soviet Union as much as it would the old Triple Alliance and other efforts by Russia to build friendly regimes around its territory in the late 19th century.
Let's bring on another caller now. Varun is with us in Middleton. Varun, hi.
Hi, yeah. About what you were just saying about, like, friendly regimes around Russia and other countries, following a Ukrainian invasion by Russia, do you think Moldova is next, or other Eastern European countries are next on Putin's hit list or list of targets? And do you think NATO is going to do anything to provide, like, any sort of support from Moldova, or, like, give them NATO membership?
Jeremy, what do you think?
Varun is asking the question that I know many American policymakers are asking right now in Washington, and I'm sure their counterparts in Europe are. Moldova, if listeners don't know the geography as well as detailed people from the region do, is on the border between Ukraine and Romania. And Russia has long made a claim on at least part of Moldova. Moldova is not part of NATO, and so there is a lot of concern. And I think if Putin is able to achieve his aims in Ukraine quickly, if he's able to take control of all of Ukraine and install a puppet regime, I'm not sure he'll be able to do that. But if he is, I think he will be motivated to move into Moldova. I don't think he's going to move into NATO territories, but I do think Moldova, which he will also claim was part of the Soviet Union and should be part of his control, I think he will move in there.
Thanks for the call, Varun. We're talking to Jeremy Suri, historian with the LBJ School of Public Affairs and Department of History at the University of Texas at Austin. With us today to talk about whether Russia's invasion of Ukraine has shifted the world order, what that means for the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the U.S. response so far to the Russian invasion of Ukraine? Sufficient, not enough, or too much? What questions do you have for our guest about the current situation, what it means for the future of American foreign policy? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the significance of this moment in history. Jeremy Suri stays with us from the University of Texas at Austin. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Sid is with us in Milwaukee. Sid, hello.
Hey, I think it's very convenient for a nation like America that's in a we are in an extremely unique situation where people have to use our currency to buy petrol, to buy gasoline for their economy to move. It's very easy to say, this is a regime and a puppet state when, yeah, the reason we don't have to do that and we don't have to invade nobody is because we can turn the lights off. We can turn their money off. It is a total hypocritic notion, and the basis of the argument is that we use democracy as a religion, and once you say democracy, then you have the moral high ground, and no one can say anything else, because in our opinion, as long as you're not physically hurting someone, you're not dominating them. It's total nonsense, and Russia has a right to police its borders such as we would. If we had an enemy, an assumative enemy, that we view it as such on our border, you think we wouldn't go to war?
Sid, thanks for the call. Sid, criticizing, I think, the idea of American hegemony. Jeremy, what do you think?
Well, the Russian argument, as Sid has articulated it well, is often that the United States has a Monroe Doctrine that goes back to 1823, and we've taken strong action to control the countries or prevent countries we don't like having influence in our region near us. And Russia has claimed that they have the right to do the same. The Chinese claim that they have the right to do the same. And I think there's an argument to that. And there's no doubt, as Sid said, that our currency, that the way the global economic system works, gives us advantages over Russia. Some of that is because people trust our currency more, but it is an exorbitant privilege, as Charles de Gaulle called it decades ago. But there is a difference with what we're seeing in Ukraine, right? It's one thing to want to have influence over a country near you. It's one thing to even exert that influence. It's another thing to send your tanks rolling across the border and to crush citizens and crush their ability to even choose their own government. This is a level of violence that we haven't really seen in that region from Russia since 1968, when they did a similar thing in Czechoslovakia, which they regretted, which the Soviet Union then regretted thereafter. So Sid is right that big countries do exert their influence on smaller neighboring countries. But in the international system, we've generally had rules that have said you don't go to the point of actually crushing and killing the people in a society simply because you want to be able to control who their government is. And in that sense, Russia is breaking the rules that we've had in Europe. Maybe they don't like those rules, but those have been the rules for just about 70 years there.
Sid, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Chris joins us now in Prairie du Sac. Chris, hi.
Hello, how are you guys?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Chris?
Well, my parents were refugees from Latvia after World War II, and so this all, of course, has stirred up a lot of concern. I had a grandpa that was sent to Siberia because he chose to disagree and all those things. So my concern is there anything that can stop Putin? What will stop Putin, I guess, is from continuing this kind of behavior? It seems like he has inflated sense of self that's not, it's impervious to any threats, any sanctions, anything. So I'm just curious what you might have to say. I'll take the answer offline. Thank you, Chris.
Thanks for the questions. Jeremy, what would it take to stop Putin from doing something like this?
Well, as Chris says, Vladimir Putin has been relatively successful over the 20 years he's been in power in using force in discreet and cautious ways. He has gone much farther now than he has at any time in his leadership of Russia. And I think that tells us something about him coming to an end at some point soon. I don't know if it's years or when. But he has now antagonized pretty much every country in Europe and many countries around the world. He's overextended the Russian military. Let's be clear. They've sent a little less than 200,000 forces into Ukraine. That is plenty of force to overturn the government of Ukraine. That is not enough force to occupy Ukraine. Ukraine is the size of Texas. And it has, like Texas, about 40 million people. You're not going to have 200,000 soldiers occupying 40 million people, many of whom are in resistance to the occupation, particularly in the western parts of Ukraine. So he's overextended himself. He's exposed his weaknesses. What will stop him is a combination of two things. First, a buildup of force around his borders, around the areas he's in now. So that's what NATO is already doing, sending a response force near the borders of Ukraine to basically make it clear to Putin that he should not move into any NATO territory. And that has to be combined with much more rigorous sanctions, which we've started to impose, that quite frankly will crush the Russian economy. Over the long term, Russia needs to import technology from the West. They need to be able to bank with the West. Their oligarchs want to be able to buy nice apartments in London and Miami and New York. And over time, the opposition in terms of economic sanctions will make it hard for Putin to keep his country functioning. And that will bring an end to his rule. It will be a very ugly end. But that's the path we're on right now.
Thanks for the call. John joins us next in Marinette. John, hi.
Ooh, I've called in several times before. You keep saying I'm from Marinette. I'm from Baronette.
But Baronette. Anyway. I'm sorry. There was a typo here. I think we heard you wrong. John, Baronette, I've talked to you before. What did you want to bring up, John?
I want somebody to explain to me why we have taken no military action against this insurgent into Ukraine. I know we have the capability to take out the first tank that came across the border in its tracks on the border, and then the second, then the third. I know we have the technology to take out the entire ship that fired on, 13 Coast Guardsmen yesterday because they wouldn't drop their weapons. I know we have the technology, and I'm so disappointed in the United States right now that I feel like we've turned into cowards, and we're not who we say we are.
John, thanks for calling in from Baronet. Jeremy, why not direct military intervention? President Biden has ruled out American troops in Ukraine, for example, so far.
Right. So John asks a very good question. We certainly have the technology from the air to take out Russian tanks and to do a lot of damage to the Russian military, but we don't have enough force in that area to actually counter the 200,000 Russian troops that were there. We could bring enough force to the area to do that, certainly, but we don't right now. And this is an old problem, John. It has nothing to do with Biden in this moment right now. Since the end of World War II, since the days of Dwight Eisenhower and Marshal Zhukov in the Soviet Union, the United States has extended a security umbrella to the western part of Europe, but we haven't been able to extend that security umbrella farther because as large as our military is, our military is committed in the Middle East. Our military is committed in East Asia. Our military is committed around Taiwan, around South Korea, Japan. And so we just don't have the amount of force, men on the ground in boots, men and women on the ground in boots, to counteract soldier for soldier. And so we could take out Russian tanks, but we can't actually put the force on the ground to keep the Russians out in Ukraine. And so that's why we try to use other forms of deterrence, as we did throughout the Cold War. That's one of the reasons we have nuclear weapons, is to try to deter this behavior.
Thanks for that call. In our last minute or so, Jeremy, what changes when this is all resolved? How does foreign policy in the U.S. look different?
I think it looks different in three ways. We will have to put more military commitment into Europe. We were moving our forces to Asia because of the growth of Chinese power. We're going to have to continue to have forces there, but we're going to need more military force on the ground, especially around Ukraine, protecting Poland and elsewhere. Second, I think it's going to be more important than ever that we work with our allies. We spent 4 years before Biden was elected trashing our allies. We did that for years before that, too. We need our allies more than ever, Germany and France in particular. And then third, I think we're going to have to really consider other options for influencing events in Russia. Obviously, force is not enough. We have to do more with diplomacy. I think we also have to get back to doing more of the work we've tried to do in the past of reaching out to citizen groups and other societies. We have to play a long game, and we have to invest in diplomacy and educational exchanges and things of that sort.
Jeremy, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again. That's Jeremy Suri, historian with the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin, author of the book Civil War by Other Means. He joined us for a look at Russia's invasion of Ukraine and what it means for the future. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Coming up after the news, the U.S. women's national soccer team reached a lawsuit settlement this week over gender-based pay discrimination. We'll find out what the case could mean for the future of equal pay in women's sports. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Food Friday, we meet the self-proclaimed cheese preacher who's with us to share great news about all things cheesy and tell us about her new book, Cheese, Sex, Death. First, a new report finds that the last two decades have been the warmest on record here in Wisconsin. That warming is happening the most quickly in the winter, and the shift is affecting winter activities and ways of life. As Danielle Kading reports, that includes the American Birkebeiner, North America's largest cross-country ski race, which will be held this weekend in northern Wisconsin.
With the sun shining overhead, Hayward's Stephen Mank skied along loops near the Berkey Trailhead as temperatures hovered far below freezing in Cable last Thursday.
I haven't missed the Berkey since 1985, and there's no sense in starting now.
The 68-year-old Mank remembers more snow and colder weather as a kid growing up in the 60s, but he says man-made snow has made a huge difference.
And as soon as the Thanksgiving comes around, the turkey burkey, we're on the man-made snow, and so we're fortunate to live close to that.
Ben Pop with the American Birkebeiner Ski Foundation points out man-made snow loops as he walks past the Berkey Trailhead.
There's upwards of, in some of the places, 2 meters of snow. Other places only have, 2 to 3 feet.
Man-made snow is something Berkey officials hadn't seriously considered until they were forced to call off the race in 2017. Warm weather and rain canceled the event for only the second time in its nearly 50-year run.
The foundation took a real hard look at, okay, what do we have to do with changing climate and the like to really make sure that this always happens? Because it was really devastating to have the race canceled.
The Berkey contributes a roughly $20 million economic impact in the region. Pop says they've spent around $500,000 on snowmaking equipment. He estimates it may cost four times that to reach a point where they could hold some sort of race in a year without snow. That may be hard to imagine after 2 feet of snow fell in parts of the region this week, but winter has warmed the most in Wisconsin. That's among findings of the latest report from the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts.
That has been true in the past, and it's expected to be true in the future.
That's Steve Vavris. He's co-director of the initiative and a senior scientist with the Nelson Institute Center for Climatic Research at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. He says the state has grown not just warmer, but wetter.
The 20-teens were the second warmest decade on record in Wisconsin, nearly the warmest, and by far the wettest decade going back to the 1800s.
In the winter, precipitation has increased 20% since 1950, and it's falling more often as rain or freezing rain. John McCarthy with Friends of Lapham Peak says that's the trend he's seen at the state park in southeastern Wisconsin.
We get less snow, we get more rain, and when we do get snow, it's followed quickly by a warm-up, and it melted or turned to ice.
Since 2004, he says the nonprofit group has spent more than $1 million on snowmaking for cross-country ski trails there. McCarthy says inconsistent snow makes it difficult to keep members involved with the Peak Ski Club. Jared Johnson with the Ebony Ice Ski Club in Milwaukee says they've also struggled to attract members as the window to hit the slopes has grown shorter in southern Wisconsin. Johnson says warmer weather can create riskier conditions that deter skiers. As ski hills rely more on snowmaking to stay open, he says that can increase costs that may be passed on to visitors and limit access.
It's much more costly to go skiing either locally or out west than it was in the past. And everything increases over time, but it has become almost unaffordable.
As people see less snow or opportunities to ski where they live, Pop says they've seen fewer people from southern Wisconsin take part in the Berkey.
If we do not have infrastructure like that where the people are, so in those population centers, people can't do it.
But he says those opportunities are expanding. He pointed to a Nordic skiing center being built in Brilliant that will offer cross-country skiing and snowmaking. He hopes that and the steps they're taking will allow the next generation of skiers to hit the trails as winters are expected to grow warmer in Wisconsin. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. Now, players on the U.S. women's national soccer team agreed to a $24 million legal settlement this week with the U.S. Soccer Federation, ending a lawsuit over unequal pay. As part of the settlement, U.S. Soccer is agreeing to pay the men's and women's soccer teams equally moving forward. One of the team captains, Megan Rapinoe, told Good Morning America that the settlement will permanently change the landscape of women's soccer.
It's a really amazing day. I think we're going to look back on this day and say this is the moment that, you know, U.S. soccer changed for the better. I mean, obviously we can't go back and undo the injustices that we face, but the only justice coming out of this is that we know that something like this is never going to happen again, and we can move forward and making soccer the best sport that we possibly can in this country and setting up the next generation so much better than we ever had it.
We're finding out what led to the settlement, what it could mean for equal pay in women's sports, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following this lawsuit? Are you glad to hear about the settlement, or do you think it goes far enough? Do you think other sports need more parity, at least in pay, when it comes to men versus women's sports? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Molly Hensley Clancy is a sports investigations reporter for The Washington Post. She's been following this story. Molly, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So for people who haven't been following the lawsuit, can you fill us in on what the team, members of the women's soccer team, were alleging when it comes to unequal pay by the U.S. Soccer Federation?
Yeah, this has been a really long saga. It started back in 2016 when the women filed a complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Basically, the core of their allegations is that the deal that the U.S. Soccer Federation offered to the men allowed them to make substantially more money than the women did. It's complicated, but you know, they said that had they been paid the way that the men were paid, they would have made far, far more money And that was kind of the core of the allegation. And you also saw them, you know, they were alleging that there were inequalities in the types of fields that they were scheduled to play on, in charter flights. The men even made more money in per diems for food and things like that than the women did. So that was the core of it.
How large of a role did public pressure play in reaching this settlement? Prominent figures, including President Biden, weighing in over the course of this thing.
I think it played a huge role. A federal judge actually ruled against the women in 2020. So in court, it was very unclear how things would shake out. They appealed the case. They'd appealed it in front of the Ninth Circuit, which is obviously somewhat more friendly to liberal or their opinions. But I think that public opinion was always on the women's side for the most part. U.S. soccer was always dealing with criticisms, and they really did not do themselves any favors in kind of how they approached the case. In 2020, they caught a ton of criticism for making legal arguments that said that women athletes were less skilled than men and worked less demanding jobs. And that got them in trouble with the public, but also with their own sponsors. I mean, I think that the pressure from sponsors who like the women's team, their women's team are a huge part of the reason they choose to sponsor the federation. So to have this fight was not just not good for the public opinion, it was also not something that sponsors were happy with.
Yeah, can you talk about the role of the women's team's success here? There are some sports where men and women in the U.S. do well on international stages. That's not the case here. The women's team, a dominant force in the soccer world. The men's team, is that part of the story? Is that part of why this particular sport could see a settlement like this?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely part of it. I mean, obviously the men's team has been doing better lately. They're sort of seen as a team on the rise, but historically the women have outperformed the men. And for the period of the lawsuit, you had the women winning the World Cup and the men failing to qualify for the World Cup. So the contrast there was just huge. And I think it wasn't solely about on-field performance. I think the on-field performance stuff led to this reality that, women's games out-earned men's games for that period. Most of the sort of most familiar, most popular players for U.S. soccer were women. I mean, you saw players like Alex Morgan and Megan Rapinoe who were just everywhere. Carly Lloyd compared to men's team players that were maybe not as established, not as, attractive to fans. And so I think that the success really set them up to make this argument that, they brought in more revenue for this time period and that they were more popular than the men's team.
Now, for the Soccer Federation, a lot of times when you settle in a lawsuit, you don't admit that you did anything wrong. You just get it done. What did we hear from the Federation as the settlement was announced?
The Federation announced the settlement alongside the players. So I think that they're really trying to project a united front. They've changed leadership since this all happened. The woman, Cindy Parlow-Cohn, who's the head of the Federation, is actually a former U.S. women's national team player. And she said, that she was the first to admit that the Federation had made mistakes in the past. I think if you look back at the time period where she was playing, the inequalities were even greater. I mean, so she certainly knew what it felt like, what it looked like to be, paid less than the men, treated differently than the men. And so I think that for them, it's not like they were outright admitting, fault, I guess, but they were quite clear that they had seen, they wanted to move forward together with the women's team and that they had made mistakes. I think that also the amount of the settlement, while it was less than what the women had asked for, it was seen by many as basically a tacit admission that this discrimination had occurred, that the women were owed back pay.
We're talking to Washington Post reporter Molly Hensley-Clancy about equal pay in women's sports, a legal settlement by the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team and the U.S. Soccer Federation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following this soccer story particularly? What do you think of this outcome, this settlement, an acknowledgement that women were underpaid relative to men, at least under the terms of this settlement? Are you hopeful for more equitable pay in the future between men's and women's sports more generally? Do you have questions about this lawsuit settlement? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Molly Hensley-Clancy of The Washington Post about the U.S. Soccer Federation reaching a lawsuit settlement with the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team over unequal pay over the years. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of women's soccer? Are you encouraged by the growth of popularity in the sport? Do you think more equitable pay can help it grow further? Are you a fan of any women's sports team at any level? Are you hoping that there's more prominence for women's sports when it comes to things like media coverage, fan support, and pay? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Molly, this is all going on at the same time as another big story in women's soccer that you've been following. Abuse of young women in the sport by coaches longstanding. I believe it was Megan Rapinoe who kind of connected the dots, saying this lack of respect in pay is part of a bigger picture of the treatment of women that led to this abuse. Can you update us on that story?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that was the dominant story in women's soccer last year was the, at least in American women's soccer, was that the National Women's Soccer League was kind of reckoned with this abuse scandal. It was initially professional women's players that spoke up both to me in the Post and in other outlets, saying that they had been verbally and emotionally abused by their coaches. One coach was accused of sexual misconduct with players. It resulted in five of the nine male coaches in the league leaving in just the space of the year amid allegations of misconduct or wrongdoing. And then earlier this year, I also reported that one of those coaches had been accused of sexual misconduct with young players, with youth players back in the 90s. So it really, you know, has put together this picture of the way women are treated in American soccer. And there's a long way to go. I think Megan Rapinoe told me, you know, this is just the beginning. And getting equal pay is just one of the things we're fighting for. And they've very had some very strong words for U.S. soccer about their failures to stop coaching abuse, to protect young players from abusive coaches,
and to
protect them from abusive coaches.
As you mentioned, this was a break. I believe you broke the story last year. What is the current state of affairs when it comes to looking into the allegations we know about and seeing if this is more common in women's soccer than we might have hoped?
There's quite a few investigations. I think the most major one is an investigation that U.S. Soccer opened into themselves, but it's being done by Sally Q. Gates, the former acting attorney general. And so she's currently in the middle of that investigation. The league is also doing its own investigation. You have FIFA looking into it. So there's a lot going on right now. I'm still, you know, looking into it as well. So I think that it's a story that's going to continue to develop, and you're going to see players really hold U.S. Soccer and hold the National Women's Soccer League accountable. U.S. Soccer oversaw the Professional Women's League for almost a decade during the time that most of these abuses happened. So it certainly played a substantial role in what unfolded in the league.
We're talking to Molly Hensley-Clancy, sports investigations reporter at The Washington Post, looking at a legal settlement between the U.S. Soccer Federation and the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team, a payout acknowledging unequal pay over the years. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Mark is with us in Two Rivers. Mark, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. To me, this is an issue of equal pay for equal value, like any employee of any company. And I don't know the answer to this question, but does women's soccer draw the same number of fans who pay the same ticket prices when they go to a game? And the television contracts, do they have the same value of the television contracts? And if the answer is yes, then by all means, equal pay. But if the answer is no, I don't see how you can justify equal pay because they don't have the same value.
Mark, thanks for the call. Molly, I guess the answer might be different if we're looking at, you know, the individual pro teams around the country versus the national team. What is the picture?
So it depends on what years you're looking at, but for the years that are covered in this lawsuit, the women's team actually out-earned the men in their games. In terms of television contracts, U.S. Soccer bundles those together, so you can't really tell who watches or who draws what numbers or what revenue from television contracts. We do know that the Women's World Cup games drew, you know, similar viewers. I mean, they certainly drew more viewers in 2015 in the U.S. than the Men's World Cup because the men, you know, weren't playing. So I think that it does absolutely matter, the revenue. That was part of the women's argument, that they brought in more money than the men's team did for this time period. Overall, the men did out-earn them over, you know, decades. And I'll also note that U.S. Soccer Federation is actually a nonprofit. It's not a for-profit company. So I think that, you know, their mission is to promote soccer in the United States. And so you can't purely look at revenue because what the national teams are not just there to bring in money. They're also there to promote the game, get young people interested in the game and you know, make appearances on television and all those kinds of things. So that there's multiple pieces of it. It's certainly more complicated than revenue and who brought in more money.
Thanks for that call, Mark, at 800-642-1234. I know we're focusing on soccer here, Molly. Is there any thought that this settlement might have ripple effects into other women's sports?
I think that the U.S. women's national team was in a pretty unique situation because of, again, the fact that they had been out-earning the men for that period because of their success. But I do think that overall you see a real moment for women's sports. There's, you know, a huge investment that was recently announced in the WNBA. And I think that for women's soccer globally, this will certainly be kind of a rallying point for other women's teams to, you know, we've already seen other women's teams in Australia, in other places push for something close to equal pay. I think that while the U.S. women were kind of uniquely situated in terms of being able to make this argument, because it's likely that we see, you know, more and more women's teams being able to, you know, make similar points about the value they're bringing.
Now, this is the national team level. I think I've seen some of the players involved in the settlement say something like FIFA next, FIFA being the governing body for soccer around the world. A former director there, I think, drew controversy for saying that, women players should wear shorter skirts or something along those lines. Is that an even bigger challenge than the national team might have been?
Yeah, FIFA is huge. FIFA is a global. Right now, the disparities in prize money between the men's and the women's tournaments are massive. Of course, there are disparities in, you know, who watches the men's tournament compared to the women. You know, the men currently bring in substantially more viewers. However, I think if you look at it, the amount of men's prize money, many people would argue, is disproportionate even to that. And I think that from FIFA, what Megan Rapinoe and others, you know, many other people have been asking for is more equal investment, not just kind of equal pay. That, you know, maybe right now you can't, well, you could, because FIFA's a nonprofit as well, but you may not be ready to completely equalize prize money yet because of the difference in viewers. But, you know, there should be a far bigger investment in women's soccer globally from FIFA because, again, you know, their mission is to promote the game.
Molly, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Molly Hensley-Clancy is a sports investigations reporter for The Washington Post. She was with us today for a look at the equal pay lawsuit settlement between the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team and the U.S. Soccer Federation. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. Hey, Wisconsin, you like cheese? We've got a guest who really likes cheese with an almost maybe even equally religious fervor. We'll find out why, learn some of the surprising history behind cheese, and get lots of advice on cheeses to try, how to store and serve them, and more. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.